Lincoln, Disc 15.
In the 3 months after his election, Lincoln issued no public statements and made no formal addresses. At most, he could be cajoled only into offering bland observations. "Let us at all times remember that all American citizens are brothers of a common country and should dwell together in the bonds of fraternal feeling." He resisted the growing pressure to reassure the South, or even to restate and clarify his views. "I could say nothing which I haven't already said, and which is in print and accessible to the public," he explained in letters marked "private and confidential." Behind his silence lay a recognition of the weakness of his position. Though the Republicans had carried the election in November, not one vote had been cast for him personally. The presidential electors chosen in that election didn't meet until December 5th, and their ballots wouldn't be officially counted until February 13th, which Lincoln regarded as the most dangerous point in the whole election process. Until that time, he had no legal standing as a public official. He was also following the advice of most leaders of his party. Immediately after the election, Thurlow Weed, who often spoke for Seward, urged him to preserve the self-respect, courage, and dignity maintained throughout the canvass by refusing to make any public statement. Joseph Medill warned that Lincoln must ignore the pleas of the damned fools or knaves who want him to make a union-saving speech to conciliate the South. He must keep his feet out of all such wolf traps. In part, Lincoln was reluctant to restate his views on the sectional conflict, lest he inadvertently cause demoralization and panic in the North. Any indication that he was frightened by Southern bluster would only throw his supporters in the North into disarray. Consequently, when Don Pyatt, a brilliant but erratic Cincinnati journalist, warned that the Southerners meant war and that within 90 days the land would be whitened with army tents, Lincoln dismissed his fears. "Well, we won't jump that ditch until we come to it," he said, almost flippantly. "I must run the machine as I find it." But Lincoln's stand also reflected his deeply held conviction that Unionists were in a large majority throughout the South, and that, given time for tempers to cool, they'd be able to defeat the secessionist conspirators. He put much faith in the old Whig element, men with whom he'd worked closely in the 1848 movement to elect Zachary Taylor, and didn't believe that any sizable number of rational citizens could contemplate disrupting the best government the world had ever seen. They must be bluffing. In the past, Southerners had threatened to dissolve the Union. In the debates over the admission of Missouri in 1819 to 1920, in the controversy over the tariff and nullification in Jackson's time, in the protracted crisis over territories acquired in the Mexican War in order to extract concessions from the North. That must be what was happening now. Appeals for him to modify his positions were just the trick by which the South breaks down every Northern man. If he agreed to it, he would be as powerless as a block of buckeye wood. But public pressure for him to redefine his position grew so great that he drafted 2 paragraphs for Senator Trumbull to insert in an address to a Republican victory celebration in Springfield on November 20th. The passage pledged that under Lincoln's administration, Each and all of the states will be left in as complete control of their own affairs, respectively, and at as perfect liberty to choose and employ their own means of protecting property and preserving peace and order as they have ever been under any administration. Widely recognized as an official statement emanating from the president-elect himself, Trumbull's speech had almost no effect in quieting public anxiety. The Boston Courier thought it foreshadowed an abandonment of Republican principles, while the Washington Constitution called it an open declaration of war upon the South. This was just what Lincoln had expected. "These political fiends are not half sick enough yet. Party malice and not public good possesses them entirely." With biblical wrath, he promised, "They seek a sign, and no sign shall be given them." A passage in the paragraphs Lincoln gave to Trumbull showed how poorly he understood the nature and extent of secessionist sentiment. "Disunionists," he wanted Trumbull to say, "were now in hot haste to get out of the Union precisely because they perceive they cannot much longer maintain apprehension among the Southern people that their homes and firesides and lives are to be endangered by the action of the federal government." Then Lincoln went on to add an astonishing paragraph. "I'm rather glad of this military preparation in the South. It will enable the people the more easily to suppress any uprisings there, which their misrepresentation of purposes may have encouraged." Wisely, Trumbull suppressed this passage. But he then went on to undermine Lincoln's pacific purpose by denouncing secession as terrorism and vowing swift action against the traitors in the South. On the night after the election, Lincoln was too exhausted to sleep, and oppressed by the responsibility that would soon be his, he began casting about in his mind for advisers who could best help him. He jotted down 8 names on the back of a blank card: Lincoln, Seward, Bates, Dayton. Judd, Chase, M. Blair, Wells. The list suggested the direction of his thinking. He was the nominal head of the Republican Party, but he recognized that he'd been chosen because of his availability, rather than because of a demonstrated record of leadership. If his administration was to be successful, he needed the support of Seward, Chase, and Bates, his principal rivals for the nomination. As he frankly told Thurlow Weed, "Their long experience in public affairs and their eminent fitness gave them higher claims than his own for the place he was to occupy." That preliminary list also indicated Lincoln's understanding that the Republican Party was not a unified, coherent organization, but a collection of rival interest groups. The most important of these were the anti-slavery former Whigs and the Free Soil Democrats, divided by party battles waged over more than a generation. If peace was to be maintained between these factions, neither must dominate the cabinet. Judd, Chase, M. Blair, and Wells had Democratic antecedents. Seward, Bates, and Dayton were former Whigs. Later, when Weed observed that such an arrangement gave a preponderance to the Democrats, Lincoln replied, "You seem to forget that I expect to be there, and counting me as one, you see how nicely the cabinet would be balanced and ballasted." Lincoln's initial list was balanced in other ways, too. Geographically, it gave one cabinet member, Gideon Wells of Connecticut, to New England, 2 William H. Seward and William L. Dayton to the northeastern states of New York and New Jersey, 2, Salmon P. Chase and Norman B. Judd to the northwest, and 2, Edward Bates and Montgomery Blair to the border slave states. In thinking of Dayton, the unsuccessful Republican candidate for vice president in 1856, Lincoln wasn't merely rewarding party service, but recognizing the powerful protectionist interests of New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Naming Bates gave tacit recognition to the know-nothing element that had supported the Republican ticket in 1860. Montgomery Blair represented both the incipient Republican Party in Maryland and the Blair family, powerful in the border states since Jackson's day. Finally, in choosing Judd, Lincoln recognized the importance of Illinois, and at the same time added a close friend to a cabinet otherwise made up of strangers. Keeping this list in mind, Lincoln proceeded with his customary caution. 2 days after the election, he asked Hannibal Hamlin, whom he'd never met face to face, to meet him in Chicago. There, on November 21st, the future president and the future vice president began a 3-day conference, which reporters described as cordial in the highest degree. Much of the time, they were joined by Trumbull, whom the newspapers called the president's mouthpiece in the Senate. And from time to time, other Republican leaders, like Carl Schurz of Wisconsin, were brought in for advice. The main item on the agenda was the selection of the cabinet. There was ready agreement that the office of Secretary of State must be offered to Seward, in recognition of his services to the Republican Party and his position in the Senate. But it wasn't certain that Seward would accept. Hurt because the Chicago Convention passed him over, he might not be willing to serve as a subordinate to Lincoln. Hence, the invitation must be so phrased that if he refused it, it wouldn't seem a rebuff to the new administration. Lincoln entrusted the handling of this delicate negotiation to Hamlin, who was experienced in the intricacies of Washington politics. Lincoln's natural caution and his inexperience in national politics almost derailed Seward's appointment. The delay in publicly naming the New Yorker encouraged an anti-Seward faction in the New York Republican Party, which included William Cullen Bryant, the editor of the New York Evening Post, and important New York City businessmen like Hiram Barney, George Updike, and W.C. Noyes. They put their opposition to Seward principally on the ground that Weed, his ally, who at times seemed to be his alter ego, had been involved in corrupting the state legislature. They wanted honest men with clean hands in the cabinet. Lincoln's slowness to select Seward suggested that he was listening to these critics. Soon the rumor spread that he didn't really want the New Yorker in his cabinet, that the appointment would be offered to him as a compliment with the expectation that he'd decline it. So damaging was this report that Lincoln felt obliged to offer Seward an embarrassed explanation that he'd all along intended to tender the State Department to him, but had delayed in deference to what appeared to me to be a proper caution in the case. Gratified, but not entirely mollified, Seward agreed to take the offer under consideration. He didn't, however, accept until Weed went out to Springfield for a heart-to-heart talk with the president-elect. After Lincoln assured Weed that in the distribution of patronage he really meant to honor his pledge, justice to all, Seward, on December 28th, after due reflection and with much self-distrust, agreed to serve. Even before Seward accepted, he and Weed had begun to press Lincoln to deviate from his original list and name one or more cabinet members from the South. This move would assure the slave states that Lincoln was going to head a truly national administration. And at the same time, it could block the appointment of Salmon P. Chase or other rivals of Seward. Lincoln was attracted by the idea, but wasn't sure it was practical. To test its feasibility, he wrote a short editorial for anonymous publication in the Illinois State Journal, inquiring whether any Southern gentleman of character would accept a place in his cabinet and on what terms. Does he surrender to Mr. Lincoln, or Mr. Lincoln to him, on the political deference between them? The strongest of the Southern Unionists that Weed proposed, Lincoln called them White Crows, was Representative John A. Gilmer of North Carolina, a conservative Whig opponent of secession. Impressed by Gilmer's sincere unionism, Lincoln invited him to Springfield. But the North Carolinian failed to understand the signal and declined. In January, Weed and Seward approached Gilmer with a positive offer of a cabinet post. But he insisted that Republicans must offer federal protection to slavery in the territories in order to appease his maddened brethren of the South. With that, Gilmer's candidacy died. The elimination of Gilmer made room for the selection of Montgomery Blair, who was on Lincoln's initial list. He wasn't from the Deep South, but he did live in the slave state of Maryland, where he had campaigned vigorously for the Republican presidential ticket. Though unprepossessing in appearance, with a mean hatchet face, Blair had considerable support among former Democrats like Trumbull and Hamlin. And John A. Andrew, the abolitionist governor of Massachusetts, was one of his backers. Despite Weed's strong objections, Blair was picked as Postmaster General. Lincoln didn't approach Salmon P. Chase until after he received Seward's acceptance. The two men were such bitter rivals that an invitation to Chase might have caused Seward to decline. But now Lincoln felt free to invite him to Springfield. He'd never seen the Ohioan, who'd just ended his second term as governor and was about to take a place in the Senate, and wanted to talk with him before offering him an appointment. When they met on January 4th and 5th, Lincoln was greatly impressed. He said later that Chase is about 150 to any other man's 100. Tall and broad-shouldered, with a massive dome of a head that hinted at vast intellectual powers, Chase, Carl Schurz remarked, looked as you would wish a statesman to look. Even this first encounter hinted that their future relationship might not be easy. After explaining why he'd offered the first place in the cabinet to Seward, Lincoln spoke to Chase about the Treasury Department. He said that Pennsylvanians had raised some objections to Chase because he was known as a free trade advocate, but he believed these could be overcome. So he asked his visitor to accept the appointment of Secretary of the Treasury without, however, my being exactly prepared to offer it to you. Chase recorded he cagily responded to this non-offer, "I didn't wish and wasn't prepared to say that I'd accept the place if offered." Despite considerable pressure from Chase's friends in Ohio and from anti-Seward Republicans in New York, Lincoln decided not to make the appointment until after he reached Washington. At Chicago, Lincoln had promised that his vice president could name the cabinet member from New England. It was a generous gesture. But Lincoln was pretty sure that Hamlin's choice would be his own. Gideon Wells, a former Democrat and editor of the influential Hartford Evening Press, who had headed the Connecticut delegation to Chicago and helped defeat Seward there. Lincoln and Hamlin settled on him for Secretary of the Navy because in the 1840s he'd served as chief of the Bureau of Provisions and Clothing for the Navy. Meanwhile, Lincoln approached another man on his original list for the cabinet. On December 15th, Edward Bates came to see the president-elect in Springfield. In their very free discussion, as Bates recorded in his diary, Lincoln told Bates that his participation in the administration was necessary to its complete success. Finding it convenient to forget that he'd written to Seward a week earlier, he assured Bates that he was the only man that he desired in the cabinet to whom he'd yet spoken or written a word about their own appointments. Recognizing that the vast ego of the 67-year-old Missouri lawyer might lead him to expect the first place in the cabinet, Lincoln explained why it was politically necessary to offer Seward the State Department. But he made the news more palatable by giving Bates the impression that he hoped Seward would decline. In that case, Bates would get the job. Until then, he could offer the post of Attorney General. Suitably massaged, Bates accepted. Lincoln's other cabinet selections were more difficult. Judd, who was on his original list, had the backing of the former Democrats in the Illinois Republican Party, but was strongly opposed by David Davis, Leonard Swett, and other former Whigs. Mary Lincoln also violently disliked him. Further to complicate matters, Lincoln had to weigh the interests of Illinois in a cabinet position against the rival claims of Indiana, which had done so much to make his nomination in Chicago possible. There, Caleb B. Smith earnestly sought a cabinet seat, and David Davis reminded the president-elect, "No one rendered more efficient service from Indiana. Without his active aid and cooperation, the Indiana delegation could not have been got as a unit to go for you." But Lincoln also had to consider the claim of Smith's Indiana rival, Schuyler Colfax, who'd supported Bates for the presidential nomination, but who'd fought hard for Lincoln's victory in the election. It was no wonder that Lincoln, as he told Thurlow Weed, found that the making of a cabinet was by no means as easy as he'd supposed. Eventually, he decided to eliminate Judd on the grounds that Illinois had already received so much recognition as the home of the president-elect. With Judd out, he had to choose between Smith and Colfax, and he eventually settled on Smith. "Colfax is a young man, is already in position, is running a brilliant career, and is sure of a bright future in any event," he reasoned. "With Smith, it's now or never." Indiana problems were simple compared to those of Pennsylvania. Lincoln didn't initially plan to offer the state representation in his cabinet because Pennsylvania Republicans were so bitterly divided. One faction was loyal to Senator Cameron, another followed Governor-elect Andrew G. Curtin and A.K. McClure, chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican State Committee. Certain that the rivals could never agree on a candidate for the cabinet, he thought that naming Dayton of New Jersey would adequately represent Pennsylvania's high tariff interests. That plan infuriated Cameron's supporters, who believed that Lincoln had not been made fully acquainted with the conversations and understandings that David Davis and Leonard Swett had had with the Pennsylvania delegation at the Tremont House the night before the nomination. Only 2 days after the election, Cameron's representatives, escorted by both Davis and Swett, descended on Springfield for an interview with the president-elect. They found Lincoln hospitable, affable, and baffling. They learned nothing about cabinet prospects, but heard story after story of frontier days. At Davis's advice, they went home and organized a letter-writing campaign in Cameron's behalf. Soon, Lincoln's desk was covered with testimonials for the senator, and he couldn't help being impressed. Shortly afterward, Swett gave him another nudge by reminding him that the Cameron influence, as much as anything, nominated you. But a chorus of opposition swelled when it became known that Cameron was under consideration for a cabinet post. Free traders fought against appointing a man committed to a high protective tariff. Opponents of Seward and Weed feared the appointment because it would, in effect, give Seward a second vote in the cabinet. But most of the hostility stemmed from Cameron's checkered record. During Van Buren's administration, he'd served as commissioner to settle the claims of the Winnebago Indians, and had allegedly defrauded his charges of $66,000. Thereafter, he was derisively known in Pennsylvania politics as the Great Winnebago Chief. Using bribery and political intimidation, much as Thurlow Weed did in New York, Cameron became the boss of the Pennsylvania Republican machine. Principled Republicans thought Cameron's appointment to the cabinet would be disgraceful. His general reputation is shockingly bad, Horace White of the Chicago Press and Tribune wrote Trumbull. Even mild-mannered Hamlin protested that naming Cameron to the cabinet had an odor about it that will damn us as a party. Lincoln worried over the problem for much of December, drawing up a memorandum of charges against Cameron and a list of the numerous letters recommending him. He tentatively concluded that, on balance, the evidence favored the senator. He invited Cameron to Springfield, and they met in the senator's hotel room on December 28th. Apparently, Lincoln liked what he saw. Despite Cameron's malodorous reputation, he appeared to be an amiable, if somewhat reserved, gentleman, tall and thin, with a sharp face and thin lips. A self-made man, like Lincoln, he'd overcome the handicap of poverty by learning to be a printer and a newspaper editor before amassing a fortune in the iron and railroad business. That his reputation was not spotless wasn't altogether a negative. Lincoln always had a fondness for slightly damaged characters, like Mark Delahaye, Lehman, and Herndon. The two very practical politicians hit it off at once. And the next day, as Cameron was preparing to go home, Lincoln sent him a brief note promising that he would nominate him for either Secretary of the Treasury or Secretary of War. Exultant, Cameron showed the letter to several friends on the way back to Washington. His rejoicing, however, was premature, for his train must have passed another bearing his old enemy, A.K. McClure, bringing documents to Springfield to prove Cameron's moral unfitness for high office. Lincoln recognized his blunder and promptly wrote Cameron that things have developed which make it impossible for me to take you into the cabinet. He suggested that Cameron, to save face, should decline the appointment. In order to ease the blow, he asked Trumbull to promise that Cameron's friends should be, with entire fairness, cared for in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. Restlessly, he waited for the desired telegram from Cameron, but none came. Hearing that the Pennsylvanian's feelings were wounded by the abrupt phrasing of his letter, Lincoln apologized that it had been written under great anxiety, and he drafted another, somewhat more tactfully phrased. "You will relieve me from great embarrassment by allowing me to recall the offer. This springs from an unexpected complication, and not from any change of my view as to the ability or faithfulness with which you'd discharge the duties of the place." While newspapers and politicians buzzed, and hundreds of pro- and anti-Cameron letters reached Lincoln every day, the Winnebago chief maintained total silence. To end the stalemate, Lincoln let it be known that he would appoint no Pennsylvanian to the cabinet until he reached Washington. Then, on his trip east, he mentioned in passing that it might be good for the new administration to retain one or two members of Buchanan's cabinet, including, perhaps, the Secretary of the Treasury. At this point, powerful business interests in Pennsylvania faced the prospect of having no voice in the Lincoln administration, and rival political factions, all of which represented the coal and iron industries, concluded it would be better to have Cameron with all his faults than to have no representation in the cabinet at all. In this disorderly way, Lincoln picked his closest official advisers. The selection process ensured that the cabinet would never be harmonious or loyal to the president. During the winter of 1860 to 61, while Lincoln was constructing his cabinet, the country was falling to pieces. On December 3rd, the Congress reassembled to hear the plaintive message of retiring President Buchanan, who deplored secession but said nothing could be done to stop it. 3 days later, South Carolinians elected an overwhelmingly secessionist state convention, which on December 20th declared that the state was no longer a part of the Union. By the end of January, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana all followed, and secession was underway in Texas. In February, representatives of 6 states of the Deep South met at Montgomery, Alabama, and drew up a constitution for the new Confederate States of America. As the southern states seceded, they seized federal arsenals and forts within their borders. Apart from 2 minor installations in Florida, only Fort Pickens at Pensacola and the fortifications at Charleston, South Carolina, remained in the control of the United States government. Late in December, Major Robert Anderson, in command at Fort Moultrie on the shoreline at Charleston, transferred his small garrison to the more defensible Fort Sumter, erected on a rock shoal in the harbor. On January 9th, when the Star of the West, bearing supplies and 200 additional troops, tried to reinforce the Sumter garrison, the South Carolinians fired on it and forced it to retreat. In Washington, government officials could not agree on how to deal with the increasingly serious crisis. The president, along with many other conservatives, favored calling a national convention to amend the Constitution so as to redress Southern grievances. The House of Representatives created the Committee of 33, with 1 congressman from each state, to deal with the crisis. After much debate, the committee proposed admission of New Mexico as a state, more stringent enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, repeal of the personal liberty laws enacted by northern states to prevent the reclamation of fugitives, and adoption of a constitutional amendment prohibiting future interference with slavery. The Senate set up a similar committee of 13, which was unable to agree on a program. But John J. Crittenden, one of its members, came up with a broad compromise proposal to extend the Missouri Compromise line through the national territories, prohibiting slavery north of that line, but establishing and maintaining it with federal protection south of that line. Crittenden's plan also called for vigorous enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act and for repeal of the personal liberty laws. In a parallel effort, the peace conference, summoned to Washington by the Virginia legislature, proposed to Congress a multi-sectioned constitutional amendment that closely resembled Crittenden's compromise. The chances for a compromise in 1860 and 61 were never great. The Crittenden Compromise, the most promising of the suggested agreements, was opposed by influential Southerners and Northerners alike. Only intervention by the president-elect might have changed the attitude of Republicans in Congress, and, in so doing, could conceivably have induced the Southerners to reconsider their position. But Lincoln considered these compromise schemes bribes to the secessionists. Grimly, he told a visitor, "I'll suffer death before I'll consent, or will advise my friend to consent to any concession or compromise which looks like buying the privilege to take possession of this government to which we've a constitutional right." Lincoln believed the real object of the secessionists was to change the nature of the American government. In his view, there were only two ways that could be done. One was through amending the Constitution, a right that everyone recognized. He himself didn't desire any changes in that document, but if the people wanted a constitutional amendment, even the one forbidding interference with the domestic institutions of states, meaning slavery, he wouldn't oppose it. The other way of changing a government was through revolution. Since the Mexican War, Lincoln had been on record as a defender of the right of revolution, of that most sacred right of a people to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. In theory, then, he might have approved when the southern states declared their independence. But he'd always carefully qualified his support of the right of revolution by insisting that it was a moral rather than a legal right that must be exercised for a morally justifiable cause. Without such a cause, he thought, revolution is no right but simply a wicked exercise of physical power. That was the essence of anarchy, which he would not tolerate. The right of a state to secede is not an open or debatable question, he told Nicolay. It had been settled in Andrew Jackson's time during the nullification crisis. It's the duty of a president to execute the laws and maintain the existing government. He cannot entertain any proposition for dissolution or dismemberment. Consequently, as he wrote Weed, no state can, in any way lawfully, get out of the Union without the consent of the others, and it's the duty of the president and other government functionaries to run the machine as it is. Lincoln's commitment to maintaining the Union was absolute. As a young man, he'd looked to reason for guidance, both in his turbulent emotional life and in the disorderly society in which he grew up. When that proved inadequate, he found stability in the law and in the Constitution. But after the Dred Scott decision, he could no longer have unqualified faith in either. The concept of the Union, older than the Constitution, deriving from the Declaration of Independence with its promise of liberty for all, had become the premise on which all his other political beliefs rested. In objecting to all compromise measures, Lincoln was out of step with the members of his party in Congress, who were better informed about affairs in the South and more alarmed as threats of secession became reality. Weed, speaking for Seward, floated the possibility of extending the Missouri Compromise line. Representative Charles Francis Adams proposed admitting New Mexico as a state without any prohibition on slavery. Even Trumbull, hitherto adamantly opposed to compromise, urged that a soothing statement from Lincoln would be the means of strengthening our friends South. They pressed him to accept minor concessions that would yield nothing of substance, but might give some support to Southern Unionists, and reluctantly he agreed. He'd always accepted the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Law, and now, to please the Southerners, he said he was willing to see it more efficiently enforced, provided that it contained the usual safeguards to liberty, securing free men against being surrendered as slaves. The personal liberty laws were enacted by the state legislatures, not the Congress. But if such laws were really or apparently in conflict with such law of Congress, they should be repealed. As for Southern concern over the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia, or interference with the interstate slave trade, he wrote Seward, "I care but little, so that what's done be comely and not altogether outrageous." He was even willing for New Mexico to be admitted without prohibition of slavery, if further extension were hedged against. But on one point he was immovable: the extension of slavery into the national territories. He continued to fear that Republicans might abandon the Chicago platform in favor of Douglas's popular sovereignty doctrine. "Have none of it," he wrote Trumbull. "Let there be no compromise on the question of extending slavery." Over and over he repeated the message to Republican congressmen: "Stand firm. The tug has to come, and better now than any time hereafter." Lincoln knew that any compromise permitting the spread of slavery into the national territories would disrupt the party that had elected him. Opposition to the extension of slavery, perhaps the only issue on which all Republicans agreed, was the central plank of the 1860 Republican platform, which Lincoln had pledged to uphold. He vowed, "By no act or complicity of mine shall the Republican Party become a mere sucked egg, all shell and no principle in it." What's more, he had a visceral objection to rethinking a conclusion that he'd reached by laborious reasoning. As Mary Lincoln observed in a different context, he was a terribly firm man when he set his foot down. No man nor woman could rule him after he'd made up his mind. His Springfield friends were familiar with that inflexibility. Some thought it showed that he had backbone. But, as William Jane said, "Some of our folks think he's stubborn." In January, when the Illinois state legislature met, Lincoln had to vacate the governor's office in the state capitol, and he rented a room in the Johnson Building. Nicolay continued to handle his correspondence, but he himself didn't spend much time in the new office. Constantly badgered by office seekers, he often took refuge in an improvised studio in the St. Nicholas Hotel, where the sculptor, Thomas D. Jones, was preparing a bust of the president-elect. Increasingly, he felt the need for quiet in order to reflect on his inaugural address. He asked Herndon to lend him a copy of the Constitution, of President Jackson's proclamation against nullification, and of Henry Clay's great speech in behalf of the Compromise of 1850. He had no need to borrow another source he intended to use, Webster's celebrated second reply to Hayne, because he already knew it almost by heart. That oration, extolling liberty and union, he told Herndon, was the very best speech that was ever delivered. When he had a draft that satisfied him, he asked William H. Balish, one of the owners of the Illinois State Journal, to have 20 copies secretly printed so he could get the advice and criticism of friends. Like her husband, Mary Lincoln was also preparing to leave Springfield. She'd found the presidential campaign tremendously exciting and the outcome highly gratifying. She was, as an Ohio cousin remarked, an ambitious little woman, and her husband's triumph satisfied her heart's desire. To those who knew her best, she seemed little changed by victory, and Mrs. Balish found her just as agreeable as ever, and as pleasant and talkative and entertaining as she can be. But the others were troubled by her growing sense of self-importance and her extreme sensitivity to suspected social slights. A Springfield minister unkindly remarked that her ego was now so inflated that she ought to be sent to the Coopers and well secured against bursting by iron hoops. Looking forward to her new role in the White House, Mary Lincoln went to New York in January, accompanied by her brother-in-law, C.M. Smith, and Robert joined her there. Aware that in March her husband would begin drawing a salary of $25,000, at least five times as much as his average annual income in Springfield, she set about ordering a wardrobe that would show the Southern dowagers who dominated Washington society that she was no frontier woman. Eagerly, merchants extended credit, and she began running up debts that she concealed from her husband. She saw nothing wrong about accepting presents from office seekers and others who sought favors from the Lincoln administration. She was, after all, now a very important person who deserved special treatment. Lincoln missed his wife. He was trying to keep house alone, and the New York Herald reported, "Whatever his other qualifications may be, it's well known that in the management of the kitchen and in other domestic concerns, he's sadly destitute of both talent and experience." On three consecutive nights, he went in the snow and cold to meet the train from the east until Mary returned on January 25th. 5 days later, the president-elect set out on a journey of his own to see his stepmother in Coles County. He had to use a passenger train, a freight train, and a buggy to complete the difficult trip. But, away from journalists and job hunters, he was in fine spirits. At dinner in Charleston, when an enthusiastic admirer vowed to shed the last drop of his blood to prevent any interference with his inauguration, Lincoln said he was reminded of the young man about to go to war, whose loving sisters were making him a belt, handsomely embroidered with the motto, "Victory or Death." "No, no, no," said the youth. "Don't put it quite that strong. Put it victory or get hurt pretty bad." he found the 73-year-old Sarah Bush Johnston Lincoln living with her daughter in Farmington near Goosenest Prairie, and had a long and emotional visit with her. Afterward, he visited his father's grave and said he intended to have a suitable tombstone erected, but he never did so. When he said goodbye, his stepmother was in tears. "I didn't want Abe to run for president," she recalled years later. "Didn't want him elected. Was afraid somehow or other that something would happen to him, and that I should see him no more." "No, no, Mama," he comforted her. "Trust in the Lord and all be well. We'll see each other again." On February 6th, the Lincolns said goodbye to their friends in Springfield at a reception, described in the New York papers as the most brilliant affair of the kind witnessed here in many years. Standing side by side in their first-floor parlor from 7 p.m. until midnight, they welcomed 700 guests who, according to the Baltimore Sun, composed the political elite of Illinois and the beauty and fashion of the area. The house was jammed, and it took 20 minutes to get in the hall door, but everybody reported the affair was a great success. Mrs. Lincoln's splendid toilette, it was remarked, gave satisfactory evidence of extensive purchases during her late visit to New York. Dozens of practical details had to be arranged before leaving Springfield. The house at 8th and Jackson Streets was rented to Lucian Tilton, a retired railroad executive, for $350 a year. For $24 a year, Lincoln took out an insurance policy on the house, valued at $3,000, and outbuildings. Surplus furnishings, like an extra mattress, a wardrobe, and 6 chairs, were sold and the rest put in storage. Designating Robert Irwin of the Springfield Marine and Fire Insurance Company as his fiscal agent, Lincoln drew up a list of the notes, mortgages, and bonds that he owned, which totaled $10,004.57, and authorized Irwin to collect interest on them and also to pay any bills that might come in after he left for Washington. Working day and night to make sure that everything was packed perfectly, Mary burned stacks of old letters and papers in the back alley. All the Lincolns made affectionate farewell visits to their Springfield friends. One of Lincoln's last calls was on Herndon, whom Lincoln hadn't seen frequently during the months after the election. The partners discussed legal matters and talked about the state of the country and the pressure Lincoln was under from job seekers. Exhausted, the president-elect told Herndon, "I'm sick of office holding already." After a time, he asked, "Billy, how long have we been together?" "Over 16 years," was Herndon's answer. "We've never had a cross word during all that time, have we?" Promptly Herndon replied, "No, indeed we haven't." There was an awkward pause, and Lincoln said hesitantly, "Billy, there's one thing I have, for some time, wanted you to tell me. I want you to tell me how many times you've been drunk?" Herndon, flustered, had no quick reply. Lincoln changed the subject to tell of several attempts to have him take another partner. Having made his point, he gathered up some books and papers and talked for a moment or two more before going downstairs. Looking back, Lincoln glanced at the law shingle of Lincoln and Herndon. "Let it hang there undisturbed," he said, lowering his voice. "Give our clients to understand that the election of a president makes no change in the firm of Lincoln and Herndon. If I live, I'm coming back sometime, and then we'll go right on practicing law as if nothing had ever happened." February 11th was cold and rainy, but a crowd of Springfield residents gathered at the Great Western Railroad Depot to see Lincoln off. Mary Lincoln had gone to St. Louis for additional shopping and would join her husband in Indianapolis. The president-elect himself had roped the family trunks and labeled them A. Lincoln, the White House, Washington, D.C. A special train had been chartered for the trip, at this point consisting of the Hinckley engine, the L.M. Wiley, a baggage car, and a saloon for the president and his party. At 7:55 a.m., the president-elect climbed the steps to his private car and paused to say a final farewell to his neighbors, one of whom reported that his breast heaved with emotion and he could scarcely command his feelings sufficiently to commence. "My friends," he began, "no one not in my situation can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of these people, I owe everything. Here I've lived a quarter of a century, and have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born, and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. Without the assistance of that divine being whoever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us confidently hope that all will yet be well. To his care, commending you, as I hope in your prayers you will commend me, I bid you an affectionate farewell." For the next 12 days, the presidential train slowly moved across the country, in a journey of 1,904 miles over 18 railroads. In addition to the president and his immediate family, the party included Nicolay, John Hay, Dr. William S. Wallace, Lincoln's brother-in-law and personal physician, and Elmer Ellsworth, arrayed in his Zouave uniform. Both Judd and David Davis, political enemies and rivals for Lincoln's affection, were aboard, and Hatch, Dubois, Yates, and Browning went part or all the way to Washington. No military officer was detailed to accompany the president-elect, but Colonel E.V. Sumner of the 1st United States Cavalry and Major David Hunter, the paymaster at Fort Leavenworth, volunteered to serve as escorts, as did Captain John Pope, who joined the party at Indianapolis. Ward Hill Lehman, resplendent in his personally designed uniform as an aide to the Illinois governor, remained close to the president-elect as his burly bodyguard. The presidential train moved from Springfield to Indianapolis to Cincinnati to Columbus. Then, after a diversion to Pittsburgh, it proceeded to Cleveland, Buffalo, Albany, and New York City. On the final leg of the journey, the president-elect visited Philadelphia and Harrisburg before going on to Washington. Special precautions were taken to prevent sabotage or accident along the route, and flagmen were stationed at every road crossing and at half-mile intervals along the tracks. For most of the journey, the presidential train consisted of 3 cars. A fourth was sometimes added, with the first assigned to journalists, who covered the journey in great detail, the second to local dignitaries, who gained prestige from traveling part of the way with the president-elect, and the third for the Lincoln family. The procession combined all the elements of a traveling circus, a political campaign, and a national holiday. Along the route, people gathered to cheer the train and, perhaps, to catch a glimpse of Lincoln. At little Ohio towns like Milford, Loveland, Morrow, and Xenia, where the train stopped only long enough for the president-elect to appear on the rear platform and bow, large crowds assembled, often with bands playing and artillery booming. At Columbus, which a New York reporter dismissed as only a second-class city, perhaps 60,000 citizens joined in the celebration. In the larger cities, the throngs were immense, and police couldn't keep them from pressing close around the incoming president. At Buffalo, there was such a wild confusion that Major Hunter dislocated his shoulder in his efforts to protect the president-elect from his overenthusiastic admirers. The stated object of this roundabout journey was to give the people an opportunity to become acquainted with their new chief executive, the first American president to be born west of the Appalachian Mountains. To satisfy this natural curiosity, Lincoln made very frequent appearances at the rear of the train, where, as he said, he could offer people the opportunity of observing my interesting countenance. Presently, he developed a formula that he used repeatedly. He came before the public, he announced, so that I may see you and that you may see me, and in the arrangement I have the best of the bargain. He could afford to joke because he generally made a favorable impression. From Columbus, the New York Herald reported that his personal appearance was pronounced by all much better than had been inferred from his portraits. Future President Rutherford B. Hayes, who met the president-elect in Indianapolis, couldn't help being amused by Lincoln's awkward attempt to bow to the crowds. His chin rises, his body breaks in two at the hips, there's bend of the knees at a queer angle. But, homely as Lincoln is, Hayes concluded, if you can get a good view of him by daylight when he's talking, he's by no means ill-looking. The journey offered superb opportunities for a politician, and Lincoln played the crowds with consummate skill. He complimented everybody and everything. At Cincinnati, he said that the greeting he'd received couldn't have occurred in any other country on the face of the globe without the influence of the free institutions which we've increasingly enjoyed for three quarters of a century. Repeatedly, he expressed admiration for the many good-looking ladies in his audiences. At Westfield, New York, he called up Grace Bedell, who'd urged him to let his whiskers grow, and gave her a big kiss. He praised the bands, and to avoid making a speech at London, Ohio, urged them to discourse in their more eloquent music than I am capable of, while the iron horse stops to water himself. Recognizing that the crowds were interested in his family as well as himself, Lincoln from time to time urged Mary to join him at whistle stops. But, as he told the ladies at Ashtabula, he should hardly hope to induce her to appear, as he'd always found it very difficult to make her do what she didn't want to. By the end of the journey, her reserve had sufficiently broken down that she consented to appear on the platform of the train at the side of her tall husband, who told the audience that now they could see the long and the short of it. Curiosity extended to the other members of the Lincoln family. The two little boys were largely shielded from the public, though they immensely enjoyed the long train ride. To relieve boredom, when visitors came aboard, Tad or Willie would ask, "Do you want to see old Abe?" and then point out someone else. Robert was much in the public eye. Labeled the Prince of Rails, a pun that combined reference to his father's manual prowess and to the enthusiastic reception the Prince of Wales had received on his recent visit to the United States, he abandoned, for once, his natural taciturnity flirted with the girls, drank too much Catawba wine, and even took a turn at driving the locomotive. The excitement apparently went to his head, and he forgot the one duty his father had asked him to perform, to guard the satchel containing copies of the inaugural address. Robert carelessly entrusted it to a hotel porter, who threw it on an unguarded pile of luggage behind the hotel desk. Expressing anger at one of his children for perhaps the only time in his life, the president-elect had to burrow through unclaimed baggage to identify his case. But fortunately, it hadn't been tampered with and no harm was done. The journey had the larger purpose of encouraging support for the Union and fostering loyalty among the Northern people. For this reason, Lincoln insisted that all reception committees and demonstrations along the route be nonpartisan. He set the tone early in the journey in his remarks at Lafayette, Indiana. "While some of us may differ in political opinions, still, we're all united in one feeling for the Union. We all believe in the maintenance of the Union, of every star and every stripe of the glorious flag." Repeatedly, he emphasized that the tumultuous welcome he received was not a personal tribute. He'd been elected president, he said, with what was surely excessive modesty, by a mere accident, and not through any merit of mine. He was a mere instrument, an accidental instrument, perhaps I should say, of the great cause of the Union. He called himself the humblest of all individuals that have ever been elected to the presidency, a man without a name, perhaps without a reason why I should have a name. The journey was punctuated by constant calls on Lincoln to speak. To welcoming committees, at receptions, to state legislatures in Indiana, Ohio, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. The demands were so numerous that he became hoarse, and at times he lost his voice. For some of the major occasions, he'd prepared little addresses while he was sitting for his bust in Thomas Jones's studio. But mostly, he had to improvise. Inevitably, there was a good deal of repetition, and some of the speeches he made along the route seemed aimless and inconsequential. Supercilious young Charles Francis Adams, Jr., was appalled to learn that the absolutely unknown president-elect was perambulating the country, kissing little girls and growing whiskers. But a more sober observer, the New York diarist George Templeton Strong, who carefully followed the presidential progress, reached a sounder judgment. Lincoln is making little speeches as he wends his way toward Washington, and has said some things that are sound and creditable and raise him in my esteem. Strong and others who followed Lincoln's speeches closely understood that he was laying the groundwork for the policies that his administration would pursue. One of his major themes was that the impending crisis was something gotten up by designing politicians. "Why all this excitement?" he asked in Cleveland. "Why all these complaints? The crisis is all artificial." Many feared he failed to understand the gravity of the situation, but his intent was to challenge Southerners to point us to anything in which they're being injured or about to be injured, because nobody could identify any specific grievances, he felt justified in concluding that the crisis, the panic, the anxiety of the country at this time is artificial. At the same time, the president-elect repeatedly asked Northerners to stand firm in the crisis. Not once in the dozens of speeches he made along the journey did he suggest willingness to agree to secession, to acquiesce in Southern seizure of federal forts and arsenals, or to recognize the Confederacy. Over and over, he stressed that he'd been elected to uphold the Constitution and enforce the laws. To those who argued this would mean coercion and invasion of the South, he responded in his Indianapolis speech with a rhetorical question. Would it be coercion if the government simply insists upon holding its own forts, or retaking those forts which belong to it, or the collection of duties upon foreign importations, or even the withdrawal of the mails from those portions of the country where the mails themselves are habitually violated? But, unwilling to precipitate a crisis, he quickly added, "Now I ask the question. I'm not deciding anything." As the presidential party moved toward the east, news from the South became more ominous. Jefferson Davis was inaugurated provisional president of the Confederate States of America on February 18th, while Lincoln was traveling to Washington. Alexander H. Stephens, Lincoln's old friend from whom he'd expected a strong support of the Union, became provisional vice president. On that same day, General David E. Twiggs surrendered all the United States military outposts in Texas to the secessionists. Lincoln responded to these developments by making it clearer than ever that he intended to preserve the Union. At a brief stop in Dunkirk, New York, he stepped from the train to grasp an American flag and asked his audience to stand by me so long as I stand by it. In New York City, he told the audience, "Nothing can ever bring me willingly to consent to the destruction of this Union." In Trenton, he promised the New Jersey legislature he'd seek a peaceful settlement of the crisis, but he warned, "It may be necessary to put the foot down firmly."
This ends Disc 15.